Sassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. I have this. First of all, does anyone have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints from that you wanted to bring up? I have this favorite one book that one text that is my at the moment favorite. Favorites. This has been my favorite for about 3 years, 3.5 years, 6 years now. And I, favorites can come and go with me, so don't take it too seriously. It's my favorite text for doing refuge, because I love the first line of it. The first line goes, the impure vision of subject and object dissolves into emptiness. And I find that so profound, such a beautiful way to start a practice. The impure vision of subject and object. The impure vision of being caught in duality. The impure vision of me versus it. The impure vision of war, which is entirely dissatisfactory, isn't it? The view of duality. Don't you find that? What, you don't? No, in fact, I like it. What?
No, I'm just thinking. As you're saying.
Yeah. There was a woman, somebody was telling me that I haven't quoted poetry for a long time, so this is it. Are you ready? There's a woman who lived in France during the Second World War. She was American. Very, very brilliant writer in that in order to read her, you actually have to think, damn. And her name was Gertrude Stein. I think some of you have heard of her. You've read lines of her poetry, maybe, or some of her famous ones. A rose is a rose is a rose. Other quotes of hers, and wonderful, interesting woman. She was in France when it was occupied, and she was living there. And so she knew a lot of people in the French Resistance, and she knew people who were what they called collaborators with the French, with the Nazis, and she undoubtedly knew Nazis. She knew people who just didn't want to be involved with politics at all, they just wanted to milk their cows. She knew people who just wanted to be artists. And she knew people who knew exactly who was right and who was wrong. And she's a very intelligent woman. So she wrote, because you notice when you have an answer, you want all other answers to die. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that? When you have an answer, you just want all the other answers. Just would you just kindly throw your legs up in the air and stop breathing? Thank you very much, because I'm right. Isn't that true? So, like, your answer is supposed to kill everything else on the field when you really have an answer. Isn't that true? It, for many of us, praise the Lord, it takes a lot, whatever Lord may be, it takes a lot to really solidify into an answer for most of us. Could be because of laziness, who knows why. But for many of us, it's very hard to really wipe ourselves up to an answer, isn't it? Or whip, probably, better word, whip ourselves up to an answer. But when we do have an answer, we really like it just to level the field, don't we? I got this answer, so I'd like things to become simpler now. Right? So she wrote, You know, that's sort of like the belief that you could actually end something with an answer, isn't it? So she wrote, "Wars are never fatal, only lost." You're never going to end duality by coming up with the right answer. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a saying that if there is a war and one side is weaker, strengthen it. So that both sides have to talk about it. So that one side doesn't win, do you understand? Because that seeds discontent and pain forever. There is no underdog in a war. There is only impure vision. The impure vision of subject and object, whatever the war may be. Whether it's a war of will or a war of won't, doesn't matter. The impure vision of subject-object dissolves into emptiness. Sometime or other, every war is going to dissolve into emptiness. Do you realize that? Sometime or other, every I and every thou is going to dissolve into emptiness. Do you know that? Sometime or other, everything that you're holding on to is going to just start disappearing. Dissolve into emptiness. Do you know that? Then what will your answer be? What will the good guys and the bad guys, the right versus the wrong, or the powerful versus the weak, or the weak versus the powerful, who cares? Who cares? I love this text. The impure vision of subject and object, as if it was possible to get an answer, right? The only way you get an answer is if you don't to look at the detail. Oh, it's a lovely day, as long as you don't look at the pollution on the roses and the fact that the baby needs changing. Right? 1,001 things, aren't there? Oh, it's a terrible day, as long as you don't look at the joyfulness of how the crickets are singing because finally the sun has come out and is glaring down. And yeah. Right? Is it true? Am I asking you? Is anybody home? Hello?
Yes.
Is that true? Have you ever found an answer that was a total answer, unmoving, unchanging throughout time and space? Have you?
Well, we believe, and I believe, there was a total answer, but it wasn't.
It wasn't. So I'm saying, have you found one that really did stand out? And yet, there is something in us that continuously looks for answers. Even the idea that there is no answer is an answer. Isn't it? Well, damn. Well, huh? It's a trick. I have this dear friend who every once in a while goes right into, "It's just a cruel joke." Because that's her answer. See? But that's still an I and other. Whatever answer there is or non-answer, is still I and other. And what is called impure vision is believing that the world is split. That's what's impure vision. Now, because we all do believe the world is split, that's all we got. We only have illusion to work with. You make the mistake when you think your illusion is better than somebody else's. Because you're ignoring the cause and effect that created that illusion. And it doesn't work to ignore cause and effect. Nothing arises without cause. Whatever arises is causal. There is no phenomena outside that rule. Whatever arises has cause to arise. How I perceive it, what I decide is my relationship to it, that's my invention. What it is, I don't know. I do know it's causal. It's based on causes, both in my perception and if it exists in the world. Is that true? We are continuously creating an illusory reality and calling it the right answer, aren't we? Have you noticed this? There are people who think you shouldn't do that. There are people who think you shouldn't speak unless you're right. There are people who think you should never be angry. There are people who think you should never be greedy. Do you think this is true? Mm-hmm. Have you met anybody like that when you looked in the mirror lately? I mean, lately?
Damn, I thought it was someone else.
And then the next moment, it's okay to just not quite tell the truth here. And then the next moment, oh no, I always am honest, or whatever, isn't it? It's like continuously, and there is this continuously dance, this dance of illusion about out there, about subject or about object, isn't there? This continuous dance, and you know it's an illusion, but some of the illusions you're really particularly tied to, right? So you'd rather not know they were illusions. You feel more comfortable if they're solid, because then that gives you permission to walk around as if there was no cause and effect. Until the shit starts to fall, you know. And then you think to yourself, oh, I just wish I could just see clearly what something really is. But meanwhile, you can see that this is clearly illusion. And that doesn't satisfy you. You say, I shouldn't be angry, which is a really big illusion. Who said you shouldn't be angry? Did you make anger? How many of you have ever read the book of Job? I'd like a show of hands on that. It has got to be one of the most beautiful and profound pieces of poetry ever written. You should read it. It's called the Book of Job in the Old Testament of the Bible. Because Job is being good. He obeys all the rules. He does everything right. And then there's this, like, just like most of the Old Testament, when it's written really beautifully, so it's like a paradox or a mystery writer or a mythology or a coyote story, God and what's-his-face, that guy with the prongs, are having this kind of dialogue about whether or not, you know, Job is a faithful servant. Old prong head here, he thinks he can... he could probably change anybody's mind about being a faithful servant. And they who includes all things, including nothing, it says, don't think so, can't shake Job. So you got permission to try as long as you don't actually hurt him, actually cause some major disfigurement. So, which is the part that's usually the hardest for people to swallow unless they look at their own lives with some honesty. And this whole thing occurs where Job goes through all these different disasters and his friends come and counsel him. He has boils all over his body, you know, blah, 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 you know. He loses his wife, he loses his kids, you know. If he had a four-car garage, he would have lost it. Instead, he lost his servants and, you know, crops failed, blah, 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 blah. And so his friends come to counsel him. And how do they counsel him? How have you counseled people who've lost? What is your voice saying to yourself? Any of you, when you see somebody having a disaster, ever think, well, they must have deserved it? How many of you think that about the States? Isn't that interesting? Well, I must have deserved it. You weren't doing good. You weren't doing good, Job. You were obviously, I know you think you've been obeying all the rules, but obviously you're not paying attention. Look, there's this number 397th rule, clause number 92A. You were not perfect. It serves you right. Now you notice that friends aren't saying that they were perfect. They're just saying that Job wasn't. It's like not looking at themselves as looking at the person who the disaster struck. Because what you got to do is distance yourself from them as much as possible. This is very classical psychology. Distance yourself from where lightning is striking by making sure you are not them. There's us and them. This friend of mine broke her arm. I was going to an afternoon thing. This was when I lived on Pender Island. This kind of, I was actually invited, even though I was a dirty, rotten Buddhist rather than a all life is oneer on Pender Island. Quite a lot of all life is oneers, aren't we women wonderful groups? And I was a dirty, rotten Buddhist as opposed to all life is one, aren't we women wonderful? So I didn't have the right colors. However, I was invited, and because I knew all the people and everything. We walked in, and everybody looked at this my friend with the broken, and they said, "What happened?" I just broke my leg. Well, that's your karma. You better figure out why you did that. You know, that's what Job's friends said to him. That's what we say when we see something that we want to distance ourselves from. And very rarely do we look at the fear that's behind that judgment. Very rarely do we just look at the fear. Because it's better if something happens because there's some inexpressible justice being meted out that I don't quite understand, but I believe in. And what's really interesting is, in one way, that those people were right. That was her karma. In another way, they're totally missing the point, because it was also my karma. It's your karma. It's your karma. It's your karma. It's your karma. Nobody's left out. So that vision of subject and object is impure because it takes a partial view and forgets it's partial. Do you see that? So in order to find that aspect of yourself that really understands wisdom, you have to practice imaging that the impure vision can dissolve. And out of that can arise a ground that can allow deity to arise, that which is the shining part of your being that doesn't articulate nearly so clearly. Doesn't have to. You shine in the dark, you don't have to say so much, you know. Because experience is more profound than view. Why is it more profound? Not because it's any less of an illusion. Have any of you ever been in the room, like for example when His Holiness the Karmapa was around doing the hat, black hat ceremony? Have you ever seen that? Any of you ever have an initiation with a lama or something where it was very profound or anything? Any of you ever been around a holy person where everybody reported seeing these different visions and things? Huh? Anybody you ever see, oh, so this person said this, I saw this, right? Anybody you, how many of you have seen something like that with Utilawanta or anybody? Has everybody had the same report of what they saw? How come? Isn't that interesting? You're still working with illusion. But now you're choosing the illusions that you work with. You're not working with an illusion that's based on a reaction to your past experience. The impure vision is basically an opinion dredged up from your fears of the past. It involves the judgment aspect. The pure vision is just as illusory, but it involves just being present to whatever it is that can be perceived. There are no screens. It's called pure vision. Some people call it love. There are no screens. Impure vision and pure vision, that's the difference. They're both illusion in one way of looking at them. So, this is an interesting book. It's called Lam Dre, and it's a teacher, Lama Chudek Yutong, who's giving a series of classes to a group of people in Australia just before they're going to receive the Lam Dre 6-week teaching that is the heart of the Sakya tradition. And the first verse is basically talking about the impure vision, and the second verse is, the second chapter is basically talking about the vision of experience. And there are just a couple of things in here that I thought it might be interesting for you to hear. So do you mind if I read some of this to you? Mm-hmm. This is an interesting topic for you so far? Okay. When we discuss impure vision, this is beautiful. I got this gift today. It says, I try to take one day at a time, but sometimes several days attack me at once. I was trying it this way for a while, but it really didn't. But it doesn't really, you know. Kind of slides down. It is actually a bookmark. Anyway. When we discuss impure vision, one of the first things we must learn to do is tolerate the use of the word impure in connection with our own experience. Isn't that lovely? Is that just beautiful? I mean, isn't it true? It may have been real to me, but that doesn't mean it was pure. It was my experience, but the vision wasn't necessarily pure, because I don't even know what pure vision is. Is that true? Mm-hmm. You ever thought you saw somebody and then they turned around and they were somebody different? What's your problem? People often reject the term, but our vision is tainted, isn't it? Tainted by our views, tainted by our moods, isn't it?
Yes.
It is tarnished. Nevertheless, it is, at one and the same time, pure. Because it is the impurity itself which contains the seeds of purity. It is not a matter of rejecting the impurity within us in order to seek purity elsewhere. We always have the potential. Our angry mind creates the impression that everyone around us is hostile. Have you noticed that? When we realize how mistaken we are to have such a hateful mind, those upon whom we projected hostile feelings will manifest quite differently. Our attitude toward them changes when we realize we have simply been polluted by our own anger. We have been polluted by our own anger. Our vision has been polluted. Our ears have been polluted. You've heard that joke about the two psychiatrists meeting in the hall, and one says the other good morning, and one says the other good morning, and then they go, what did they mean by that? Such anger poisons our relationships and blinds us to all the good things in our lives. Is that true? In addition to anger, greed, ignorance, jealousy, and arrogance also need to be transmuted. It's not a matter of replacing them with pious qualities we don't have. There is no concept of ultimate good and evil in Buddhism. I'll do that again. There is no concept of ultimate good and evil in Buddhism. I'll do that again. There is no concept of ultimate good or evil in Buddhism. There is no inherent evil other than the transient, unresolved mind which projects anger and hostility. When we feel angry, this is just a distorted manifestation of what we truly want to be. When we feel angry, this is just a distorted manifestation of how we truly want to be. If we are learning to dance, our feet have to learn the steps. It makes no sense to reject them when they make a mistake. Despite our hopes, we won't get a new pair of feet to dance with next time. Many spiritual teachings kill the real essence. It is very important for us to remember that impure vision is really the essence of the path. Impure vision is what we have. That is also what we make. If we use it right, is the path. If we don't use it, if it uses us, it's the path of blind wandering. If we use it right, it's the Eightfold Path. It is very important for us to remember that impure vision is really the essence of our path. It is our raw material. If you are an angry person, cherish that reality. Isn't that something? I am not saying you should inflame your anger or justify it or go around and, you know, win anger contests on the neighborhood or anything like that. He doesn't say all that, I do. That would be foolish. But remember that it is through your anger and the way you deal with it that you are going to grow. First, by recognizing that you don't like the results of it, and then figure out how you can use that mind, which tends toward anger, with the same sharpness of anger, but without the result or the killing quality of anger, right? How do I do this? How do I use this mind, which has a tendency toward anger? What is the gift of anger? That's what you say. Okay, I know what the crap of anger is. What's the gift? The crap is like all those corpses littering my rug, where I used to have friends sitting around. What's the gift of anger? Right? What's the gift of greed? What's the gift of stubbornness? What's the gift of jealousy? What's the gift of grief? What's the gift of despair? What's the gift of fear? Not trying to change them. You're not going to do that anyway, are you? Eh? You need to read Job. Job spent a whole lot of time when the first thing started happening really trying to change it, right? Make himself more perfect. Then his friends came and said he hadn't tried enough. And he got pissed off. Told him to go away. Go talk to somebody else. You're calling yourselves my friends, he says. This is friendship? That's a good point. And then God answers Job out of a whirlwind. He says, how come you know what the right answer is, Job? He says, I just don't remember. Where were you when you created your eyebrows? God, you did a good job there. How about when I, you know... out of nowhere, the planets came into being. Were you on my right or on my left? I just have a little trouble remembering that now. God answers Job out of the whirlwind. What is it you're going to change? What is it that you're going to be better or worse for? When are you going to turn around and look directly at the state that is pushing to do that? And decide what the power, the gift, what is that state? What is the energy of that state? And because it's all illusory, what illusion would you like to choose to use with it? Rather than be driven into a blind wandering. Does this make sense to you? So, I'm not saying you should inflame your anger. That would be foolish. But remember that it is through your anger and the way you deal with it you're going to grow. Denying anger, feeling guilty about it, do not help that much. Do they? It's better than not knowing you're angry, but it doesn't help that much, does it? We were all born with our own character and personality, and that is also our potential. This is the Buddha nature in hiding. It is important to see how impure visions are created and how they manifest. So it's important not to just act on them or believe them, but feel. You can feel when the anger is coming, can't you? You can feel when judgment is coming, can't you? You could feel, because there's usually what? A sense of uncomfortableness just before one of those habits? Greed, right? You have to go shopping and buy 50,000 things that you're going to take back later. Just before you feel, there's this kind of discomfort, isn't there? This restlessness, isn't there? Just before you get mad, huh? Isn't there? This kind of just things aren't quite right. You're looking, aren't you? You pay attention. You pay attention and you know, oh, here comes the usual pattern. Now, do I want to repeat it? Because I know where it goes. Blind wandering. Isn't that true? This is the impure vision of subject and object. Me and it's going to satisfy me, or it's never going to satisfy me, or I'm not sure whether it will satisfy me or not, so I'm going to have a philosophical discussion about it while everybody else, until they all get bored and go home, and then I'll decide later in the safety of my own. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Three ways of working, right? Is that true? We go through these things. We go through them trying to figure out why is this happening? Why is this happening? Or, okay, now I got, this is the way I'm going to deal with this. And then the whole pattern starts again, right? Same kind of relationships form around you, don't they? The same kind of dilemmas, don't they?
Yes.
Same experiences over and over, don't they? So at what point do you start actually feeling that slight edginess before it gets into the full theater, right? Before you've got the stage setting, the stage directors doing the props, and you know the cue girl there sitting there with the book, and you know all the floodlights and the tickets sold and everything. Before you get that far, which point do you actually have the right to say, okay, what is this energy? What is it good for? Not just be driven by it to perform your usual way, but what is the feeling of this energy? How else could I use it? What is its talent? Because anger has a talent, doesn't it? Greed has a talent, doesn't it? Not so sure about that, some of you? No?
What is it?
Greed has a talent.
What do you think? What is the feeling when you're really just going to try everything? What is the feeling?
Discriminating.
No. Pay attention. Just pay attention. What is the sense of greed that's so... Huh?
Interest,
yeah. And actually, you know, if you're in a... You know, a Bernard Galibault shop with you know, free samples of everything, and you happen to be practicing greed, are you going to be worried that you might get a stomachache?
No.
Are you going to wonder whether maybe one of them might be poisoned? I don't think so. You must be joking. Are you going to wonder whether the tastes will go well together? Or whether you prefer white or dark? No, because you're going to prefer the one you're putting in your mouth right now, right? The thing about greed that is unmistakable is the faith. The faith, the confidence, the power to take the next chocolate. Moving right along. We're into ginger now.
No discrimination in that.
Mm-mm. Exactly. So therefore, when you're working with a greed type, what do? Huh? I notice the greed type shuts her mouth and looks at her feet right away.
You give them a poison chocolate.
Give them a poison chocolate, or one that tastes bad at least.
Or one that you've bitten out of already.
And spat on, with a little phlegm in the spit. Because that just stops it right there, doesn't it? Because there's no way to satisfy greed. Because faith is boundless. When confidence is there, it's there, isn't it? You do anything when you're confident, can't you? But you need to ask a little question, what am I confident about here? So what you do is you put a fly in the soup. That's what Buddhism says. You know, you are like totally caught in this helpless love affair. You allow yourself and you can't get over it. You keep fantasizing about this being. What do? You let yourself get through the full fantasy of them. There they are. Oh my God, they're so good. Oh, they're reaching right for you. Oh, and then you imagine a booger hanging under their nose. And it just goes ching. Then you focus on yourself. Then you focus on your own body. You say, I am here, I have the right to be here. And this is, you do that like at the most 3 days, and your absolute addiction to greed is gone. Because greed is basically the sense of not having your own ground, because you basically don't like yourself. You think that there's something missing, so you're going to eat as many chocolates as you possibly can, because maybe this one will fill that up. Hatred is basically the sense that nothing out there is ever possibly going to be suitable. That no matter what you involve yourself with, it's going to hurt you, disappoint you, cause problems, right? So hatred, when it's looking at things, can see exactly where there could be, you know, yeah, that 79th thread on those pants. Whoever the worker was on the weave, they didn't get the color exactly the same as all the rest of the woven pant there. This is a wrong. Hatred goes for discrimination, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I know exactly why, you know. This fly, this windshield sucks because there is that fly 3.2 inches from, right?
Yeah.
Your earlobes are disgusting. Have you ever thought of having an earlobe job? You're a perfectly fine person except for your earlobes. Right? Just pins on something and cannot let go. Hatred, right? And detail. Right? So the strength of hatred is that ability to focus. The weakness of hatred is that ability to focus, because it loses space, doesn't it? May see the fly, but it misses the whole windshield. Right? It's so busy criticizing the fly that it forgets to watch where it's driving and then blames everybody else. True? So caught in one detail that crashes the whole plane. Right? Do you understand that? So discrimination is the strength as well. Isn't it?
Yes.
Of anger. Faith is the strength as well as the weakness, confidence, faith, of greed, isn't it? So when you start taking it and not just being driven by it, that when the subject, when the sense of the self is there, and then one of these emotions comes up, and you don't just automatically allow the blind responses of the past to cause you to pin on your usual story. Do you understand that? You don't just like the subject and object just arise based on your past. You're actually there. You're actually present. You're saying, oh, here is this feeling. Oh, here is the mind that has powerful ability to believe or powerful ability to see what's wrong, to be right. Does that make sense? Then you start to say, okay, now how do I want to use this? You're still working with illusion, but you choose the illusion because you know that cause and effect is real. Because whatever illusion you're seeding, you're going to get the results back from that. Enlightenment doesn't take long, you just have to do it. It's very simple. Yeah? Enlightenment is the result of actions. We're always working with illusion. The instructed disciple is the one who chooses the illusion that they're working with. Is that clear? Knowing that they would prefer not to be caught in anger, they choose the illusion that they're going to use that pinpointing mind, that intelligent mind of anger, to find something beautiful that they approve of. Is that clear? Find beauty. Because they know if they find anything less than beauty, they're going to go, you know, they're going to trash everything within 20 miles. And I've done that once or twice, or 20, or 50, or 70 lifetimes, or, right? Is there anything familiar about this?
Yes.
They say, right? They say, yes, there is. So they say, okay, I'm about to fall into illusion. Which one do I choose to perceive as being valuable? Perception is a choice. This is a very Buddhist idea. Having gone to that point, we will now skip ahead to the vision of experience, which says, today I would like to talk about the possibility of developing a new kind of perception. This is less mundane than the way we normally see things in everyday life. If people are not having a happy day or are dissatisfied with a relationship, are not happy with their health or work or whatever, this unhappiness is created by their perceptions. If you want me to reread anything, just ask. In the last talk, I referred to this level as deluded or impure perception. That's what impure perception means. It will determine how we react to praise of other people and how we receive praise or criticism of ourselves. If we receive criticism with a sense of appreciation, it isn't threatening. Do you think that's true? Mm-hmm. Some of you can't even conceive of receiving criticism with appreciation. But it's your choice. If you do receive criticism with appreciation, it's not threatening. It's your perception that makes it threatening or not. Or, as they say in Buddhism, no one has the power to hurt you. You have the power to hurt you. If we receive criticism with a sense of appreciation, we won't feel threatened. Instead, we find room to improve. It is our attitude which dictates our experiences. You all saw being there, didn't you? Rather than the things which happen around us. This is a fundamentally important discovery. I'll read that again. This is a fundamentally important discovery. I'll read that again. This is a fundamentally important discovery. It helps us to realize that we could have been happier about things in the past if we had known about this, instead of rejecting unpleasant experiences. Because we're looking for the right answer based on what we already know rather than willing to be present. Because of our lack of awareness. Many of our sufferings appeared as sufferings only because of our habitual modes of thought. Our attitude was such that we couldn't do better at the time. And similar experiences manifested again and again with different people in different places. The mirrors may have changed, but the reflection we have seen is always the same. Objects function as mirrors. One who doesn't know the true nature of the mind usually blames the mirror for his own image. All shared experiences of sentient beings are impure vision. Just reflections of karma and cause and effect, karma and effect rising, coming into being and passing away. People seek out religious teachings to try to improve their habitual patterns and learn to do things differently. Do you think that's true? This brings us to the topic of today's talk, the vision of experience. The richness of our spiritual experience depends solely on how we evaluate our deluded perception. The richness of our spiritual experience depends, S-O-L-E, solely, only, solely, on how we evaluate our deluded perception. How we value it. How we evaluate. We can learn to alter the way we see things. How can we learn that if you see something that always makes you feel unhappy? You know there are things, all of you, that always makes you feel unhappy, right? When you see that, then you can practice to yourself saying, next time this arises, I would like to have a choice about whether I think this is unhappy or not, or unhappy or not. I would like, when this pattern arises, I would like to have the choice of how I perceive it. Did that make sense to you? Yeah? When you notice that you always get angry in traffic, you could say, the next time this anger comes up, I would like to have a choice as to how I use it. So then the anger comes up, you see yourself just seeing exactly what it was you were pissed off, that car didn't leave enough room before it cut in. Then immediately you take that energy and you find something to look at that gives you a sense of beauty. I'm so glad that car didn't leave enough room because I had to really brake here, so therefore I can see this. Thank you for that gift, car. Right? Do you hear that? So that you are not repeating the same patterns, because I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the thing that continues after we die are the habits. Thank you. Exactly. So it would be nice to maybe have 3 or 4 habits going. When you don't have the body to give you ballast, you can maybe jump more into one direction, you know? Start now. I love that sentence. The richness of our spiritual experience depends solely on the way we, on how we evaluate our deluded perception. Isn't that beautiful? Solely damn, nobody else is to blame. It follows that if we change ourselves, we can develop some flexibility once we understand that we are the authors of our perception. And that's true, isn't it? And you know that from experiences where you thought you were looking at one thing and then the person turned around and, you know, and they were somebody else, and how there is this one perception, and then the perception altered, and the whole reaction and the whole interchange was totally different, right? Mm-hmm. So, but that's like by chance. Why don't you do that yourself? Why don't you choose to focus on joy? Why don't you choose to focus on kindness? Without negating or trying to get rid of or making yourself right, why don't you just play around with it and say, okay, now this is where I usually get angry. What would happen if I made it into a gift rather than a robbery? Right? So someone said to me when I was talking about this in Calgary the other day, well, yeah, what? How do you make, you know, a bank robber, or who has a gun because this person had been held up, into a gift? Do you have any answers?
Shows you how you react when there isn't a story to be told that's actually really happening.
What if you're shot? What if your father is shot? I mean, that's true. But even more than that, there is one more thing that we tend to ignore, is that all beings are working with the same stuff. Do you hear that? All beings are working with anger. All beings are working with greed. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
All beings are working with the same stuff. All beings eventually will find the way to not be caught by impure vision and to develop the vision of experience, and then from the vision of experience, from the concentration and the confidence, the blissfulness that comes from that vision of experience, to use the Buddha's words from yesterday, have a true state of being able to hold the mind and look deeply into reality and move beyond suffering. Right? All beings are doing that. Do you understand that? Do you think that's true? Huh? It's not possible, it's true. All beings are awakening. Whether or not I want to believe it or not, much as I would love to be able to create a certain little hell and throw the few people that I really have decided don't quite deserve to be in the ground with me into this sort of pit somewhere, there is a part of my being that would always worry about them, that would feel uncomfortable, would like to let them out. Does that make sense to you? I do not believe in perpetual evil. I do not believe in perpetual hell. I do believe that sometime or other, someplace or other, every person, no matter how demonic they may seem to be, is really going to get bored with the demonism. Pardon me? What do you mean?
We're assuming that we're all moving towards good.
We're all moving toward pleasure. I don't believe we're moving toward good. I believe we're moving toward pleasure. Do you think you do things more for pleasure or for pain? And it's more pleasurable to be happy than it is not to be happy. I have proved that many times in my own life. Because of Pavlov. But because of the Pavlovian theory, or the truth, we are all destined to awaken. That's the Buddhist statement. All beings desire pleasure. The greatest pleasure is to be no longer subject to suffering. Eventually, some lifetime or other, all beings are going to get there. Maybe some beings are going to get there through guilt. A lot of people learn how not to be greedy through guilt, don't they? Huh? A lot of people learn how not to have hatred through guilt, don't they? Because it doesn't feel good. Yeah. But some lifetime or other, all beings are going to move toward the greatest pleasure, which is to be free of suffering. So whenever there is some action that I think is demonic, I don't know whether that is the point where that being. What would be more useful for me, going out hating them so that, you know, the death moment and the rebirth moment will be based on that kind of hatred and fear? Or going out saying, okay, I totally offer this lifetime to you, and may this be the one that ripens you into giving up murder. Giving a gift with strings attached. Which would be more fun to do. You know what a prankster I am. I would just love that if somebody was killing me, just to turn it around so that they couldn't get away from it. May my voice and the love of my being continuously whisper in your ear so that you're unable to kill. Wouldn't that be sweet? May this be used that all beings understand happiness and the causes of happiness. I wouldn't mind that. What about you? Do you understand how that is like a direct hit at the sense of revenge? And that revenge is like a knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? It's what you do when you're young. You know, your brother hits you, you hit him back, right? Your parents reprimand you, you go out and play, and you play at reprimanding the other kids, right? Don't you? And what are you doing that for? You're deciding how you like it. Does it work? If somebody says, I'm not going to play with you because you reprimand me. Oh, maybe I won't try that. Okay, I won't do that. What do we play? This is called, you know, now the vision of experience where you let go of your past answers and trust yourself just to be there without judgment. It follows that if we change ourselves, the things around us will change, this realization, and it follows that everything is changing, really, is what follows, but that's okay. This realization produces a great sense of freedom. If we can't change our thoughts, if we can't forgive, we will be living in a state of constant delusion. A person who has forgiven someone feels free from that person, instead of being trapped by the experiences. Isn't that true? Most people are victims of the past and of their perpetuated and exaggerated perception of it. Isn't that true? Thank you. The longer deluded perceptions drag on, the more gigantic they become, and the harder it seems to let go of them. But you know what? Only takes 1 second to let go of them. 1 second. The second you do it. We need to find ways to forgive the past and to forgive ourselves for having been such poor projectors. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
We need to see our potential for changing our projections. We need to see that. Gee, I could change the film. I'm sure we have all had brief glimpses of the vision of experience when our whole attitude was changed by a flip of the mind. Mm-hmm. Sometimes two people are at loggerheads. It doesn't take much to change this. All it needs is for one or the other to say sorry. The hurt has been done, but how people continue to perceive each other afterward is the real problem. When does terror stop? When does abuse stop? That's the real question. Not whether it happened or whose fault it was or who did what to whom, but when does it stop? That's the real interesting question. If we focus on self-pity and persist in regarding some as victims and others as not, the deluded perceptions gain great strength. Usually people who have a poor opinion of themselves will continue with a very deluded perception of the world and the people around them. Because they are unhappy with themselves, they cannot see anything positive in the outside world. In the course of the teaching on impure vision, there is much discussion about the precious human birth. Once we start reflecting upon our great good fortune in being born as human beings with access to these teachings, minor complaints and hurts fade into insignificance. If people do not understand the precious human rebirth teaching, they will always think there is something wrong with their lives. They will think that they are the only ones who are missing out. As soon as we realize how precious life is and stop coveting things we don't have, we become much happier. The Buddha said, one of the types of suffering is the desire for an experience other than that which is present. As soon as you stop doing that, you become much happier. No kidding. We begin to perceive all our relationships differently. Many of us keep coming and doing the same practices, doing the practices again and again. This is because we have had a glimpse of intellectual clarity. But long-lasting perception is what we're after. Isn't that what we're after? Long-lasting perception. We want to be kinder, more forgiving, wiser, more patient. Today's topic takes us a little further on. A person must initiate himself to allow these experiences to occur. It's not going to come from outside. You have to initiate this perception yourself. You have to just be willing to see if you can do it once. That's all. The one time you think of doing it. And you do it the one time, however many times that one time might come up. You don't do it forever, you don't make a big thing about it, you do it once, whenever it comes up to do. Today's topic takes us a little further on. A person must initiate himself to allow these experiences to occur. People who go for short retreats definitely feel some immediate benefit. The experience is enriching. It's not just a matter of belief or faith. The vision of experience consolidates the teachings. It is only through such experiences that we can know whether we are out or in, on the path or off the path. Being on the path doesn't mean that we have to do practices all the time. We could be doing all sorts of things. The vision of experience means the vision where you're actually there, present, and it is that immediacy, like when you are trip on a step or something and you're suddenly there. It can still be illusory, but there is an awareness in it. Do you understand? It can still not be seeing things as they are. It's still not awakened, but it's aware. Awareness is present. That's called the vision of experience. The impure vision of subject as object is habitual thought. Is that clear? One needs to be able to move. Identify when habitual thought is there. The best way to do that is to do the meditation on precious human birth, where you begin to be able to see these thoughts inside you, outside you, doesn't make any difference, and actually identify, this is. You do that by actually calling it up over and over and starting to say, oh yeah, gee, they are here. Rather than, oh, I don't really want to see them, I don't want to know too closely, I can't, I don't want to look, so therefore I'm going to dull out. Right? So like you do the precious human birth, you don't even have to do it in depth, you just have to do it as much as you're able. Reading it when you're on the toilet, I don't care. Do it every day, do something of it. And that begins to move the mind out of the impure vision of subject and object. Because then you begin to notice that there are just these mind states arising. They're arising outside, they're arising inside. And nobody is better, worse, or the same as anybody. Conceit is not an issue. Right? Instead, it's just these mind states. And how does one want to use them? Then awareness immediately begins to develop. It is like the most painless process because it is your own interest that takes you through it. So it moves from the impure vision to the vision of experience simply because you begin to get interested on what it is like to drive the car without 20 chains dragging off the back, carrying huge railroad cars and the emergency brake on. Do you get better mileage that way? And when the answer is yes, you enjoy the ice cream cone you buy with the difference. And because all things are done for pleasure, you will like the ice cream and you'll want to buy more. So you'll save more money on fuel and start to, in fact, every once in a while, notice you can give somebody else a ride. Doesn't matter whether they enjoy it or not. You enjoy, notice that you got all this room because you threw out all those chains and stuff. Kind of fun. So it moves from the impure vision to the vision of experience. And then when the vision of experience is operating and there is awareness, then you can have the mind can be concentrated, there is faith in yourself. Then you can start asking, what's reality? Then you can start approaching whether or not you're seeing things as they are. Then you can start performing visualizations and experiences, you know, following paths that actually take you to the essence of your real interest. What's going on? Is that clear? Is that interesting to you? Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Narrow you one. If you don't do the meditation on precious human birth, you basically end up like the guy, you know, that beautiful Sufi story, where this great Sufi teacher is walking along and he meets this drunk who's looking for his keys. It's nighttime and this drunk has lost his keys. He kind of dropped them. And they're both looking for their keys, you know, and he's looking for his keys, and this great Sufi teacher comes along, and he says, "Oh, what's wrong?" He says, "Oh, I'm looking for my keys." He says, "Oh, did you drop? Oh, here, let me help. You know, what are they like? Oh, they're quite large, and you know, if I just see them, I should be able to find them right away." And they look and look, and I can't see them anywhere. And he said, "Are you sure you dropped them here?" "Oh, no, I dropped them over there in the dark, but there's not enough light there to look, so I'm looking here where the light is." And that's exactly what most of us do. We would prefer not to look at the anger in our being. We want to look where we perceive the light as being. We prefer to see in other people where the darkness is, where the keys for our own house is. We tend to look for in other people, in the dark. But in ourselves, we look for the light, don't we? Why we are right, don't we? But that's not where the keys are, folks. That's not where the keys are. And eventually, you're going to have a hangover and want to be home. Because you're a drunk. Drunk on the thoughts of delusion. You want to find the keys, you got to look in the dark, in your own being. When you can face the dark in your own being, rather than trying to run from it, it's not nearly as frightening as you think. Your judgment of yourself is a lot worse than yourself. You're just like everybody else. Oh, damn. What we do with it, that's what makes the difference. What we do with it, somebody said to me just the other day, they phoned me from Ontario, they're at this meditation center, which some of you know about. They have to go home because there's some problems with their family. They're talking to somebody about this, that they really were just looking forward to being at this retreat. And this other person says to them, "Oh, that's how you can tell when you're on the spiritual path, because then everybody starts fighting to get you off it." Mm. They phone me and they say, "Is that true, that when you're really on the spiritual path, then you notice a lot of resistance, more troubles start, people start arguing with you?" No. It's not my experience. My experience is when I'm on the spiritual path, I have more quick awareness of how many times I would choose to feel blocked, or choose to feel that something is not spiritual, or choose to feel that I'm a cut above everybody else and decide to change my mind. For me, the spiritual vision is when I can see Buddha nature everywhere. Because mirror, like wisdom, is spiritual vision. You cannot separate the I from the perceived. It is the mind state that is perceiving. So if you think you're somewhere up high on a path and everybody's trying to bring you down, probably you're not practicing compassion. Probably you're practicing elitism. Do you think that could be true? And you think that these people are not really spiritual, so you want to spend time with these people who are spiritual. Does that make sense to you? Now, it might be that what you need to do is get away from people and do a retreat, but you're doing that for the benefit of compassion. Not because some people are total assholes and these are the saints over here and I belong with the saints. Not God realm. And so the impure vision is what gives you the indication. The impure vision is where you begin to learn to practice perception. The pure vision is when you realize the power of perception, so that when you meet anger, you know you have just met Akshobhya Buddha, and you bow. You bow. Ah, Akshobhya Buddha has just walked into my consciousness. It's the power, the same power as anger. Or you meet jealousy. Ah, here is Amoghasiddhi Buddha, Dhyani Buddha, Wisdom Buddha. Or you meet lust. And you say, ah, here is Dhyani Buddha, Amitabha. Perception. Or you meet miserliness or hoarding, or and you say, ah, Dhyani Buddha, Ratnasambhava. Essence of richness. These are all these fruits, so many, many desires to hold on to this, now coming into fullness. These are these seeds of karma ripening. How wonderful. But that takes some practice to get to that point. You have to be able to turn the impure vision of subject-object. You have to be able to let it dissolve into emptiness. Isn't that a beautiful line? The impure vision of subject-object dissolves into emptiness. Because doing that all the time, isn't it? As you flip from one view to the next. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the right answer. Then, like 10 minutes later, you got another right answer, don't you? Slightly adjusted, depending on, you know, how your mind has played around with this or that. But somehow or other, one view is sent to dissolve into emptiness for the other view to rise out of it, hasn't it? So what you're doing is you're allowing yourself to be aware that that's what's happening all the time. Continuously, the impure vision of subject-object is continuously dissolving into emptiness and then being reborn. What is the rebirth dependent on? Well, let's say the rebirth should be dependent more on how you choose to use perception. How you choose to perceive. It worked for Peter Sellers. I have one more line. He's talking about people having meeting a great teacher and having these experiences, these perceptions of profound miracles occurring, right? He's talking about perception, because that's what the vision of experience is based on, perception, isn't it? And then he is talking how that too, the vision of experience, is also the perceptions that arise. Like I said, many of you can be in front of a teacher or some being and see incredible things, but you won't all see the same incredible thing, you know? So it's perception we're talking about here. When people have unshakable faith, they can experience that kind of perception. They can see the miracles their teachers display. These are not necessarily instantaneous, pure vision on the part of the disciple. They may be seeing miracles, but it isn't necessarily the pure vision of the awakened mind. It is the vision of experience, but it's still illusory. It's not the pure vision of the awakened. Is that clear? Okay, so there. They may occur mainly through the power of the teacher. If anybody else had been there, he would not have seen these things in the same way. The vision of experience is usually, however, a culmination of both one's practice and one's devotion.
Can you read that again?
The vision of experience is usually a culmination of both one's practice and one's devotion. So I think that's enough for this evening, isn't it? Practice and devotion. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Question? Was that a question?
Yeah, just explain devotion a little bit. Just practice that devotion.
What aspect of devotion?
Well, is it paying homage or is it?
It starts basically with a strong sense of interest.
Okay.
Strong sense of interest. Because that's usually when we notice our devotion. Many of us are very careful, so we like to think we don't really experience devotion. Don't you think that's true? Westerners, we have a kind of a suspicion of devotion, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I know for most Westerners it's really hard for them to admit they love their parents until they're well past their 25th year. Have you noticed that? Some of us wait until they're dead before we can do it. So let's say interest. I think devotion is a sticky word for many of us. Because we can feel it, but then we can't allow ourselves to name ourselves and to name it. Because what if we're wrong? Huh?
Mm-hmm.
There has to be this sort of screening it. It's impossible to live without devotion. It's impossible to live without trust. It's impossible to live without faith. It's impossible to live without love. There is love. But whether it's our guilty secret or not, that's the question. That's funny, isn't it? Because we know we love. Whether we actually make room for that, for the little moments, those exercises like 6 times a day saying, I approve. If you wonder what you mean by devotion, do that exercise again, because you've hidden your own devotion from yourself. Just do that exercise, that sort of makes the space again, and then you remember, oh yes, of course I'm devoted. Of course I have this sense of joy about being here. Of course I am grateful for my teachers. Of course I am a lover. We get so that we're too busy going into the future, so we forget to be here. What sustains us here is devotion.
See another person, I see a Catholic lady crashing to her knees on the bus when I was driving to Montreal. We were going along a certain resolve, she could bump on her knees. And then she could bump again. Each time she passed a church, she would bump on her knees. And I thought, my God, what delusion. And then I thought again, well, I don't know what she's experiencing. But it didn't have an appeal for me. But I get the sense of devotion, of being devoted to a certain line of endeavor. I devote myself to do this. I'm writing something. So I devote my time to researching it and allowing it to come in. I'm fully committed and devoted. So I have to watch the difference between devotion and delusion.
I'm not sure I follow the last statement.
Well, I have to see the difference between devotion and delusion.
But delusion is the impure vision of subject and object. And so what you're doing here is you got two things. You got devotion and practice. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the practice is already the practice of changing the perception. And all there is delusion. So it's like choosing better delusions. So whatever the devotion is, begin to make it more clearly aimed, right? Devotion is always present, just like delusion is always present, or views are always present. Devotion is there. If one has not allowed oneself to be present and been willing to explore who is it that is here, then one will have the devotion going to what you're calling delusion, from what I hear. But that doesn't mean there isn't passion. That doesn't mean there isn't devotion. You know, what's his face, the guy who was collecting 99 finger bones, Angulimala, right? He was devoted and there was a delusion, right? He had one more finger bone to collect and he would have got his 100. Do you remember that story? Of Angulimala? He was murdering people because he had to make a rosary out of finger bones for his teacher. He had one more to go. And he became one of the great saints in Buddhism. Killed 91. That's pretty good for a serial murderer. Yeah. So the passion of his devotion, if the delusion is turned to the service, you know. I mean, we all have devotion. Some of us are really devoted to not making any move. Aren't we? And so if we start to do the practice and the devotion together, that can move. So it's like, I understand what you're saying, that it's easy with devotion when devotion gets hooked up to a dangerous idea. Is that sort of what you're saying? Yeah. And in one way, I suppose that's true, because I think it would be a lot easier path not to be somebody like Bin Laden. You know? I don't think that's an easy path. Or any killer, or any, you understand? Any bomber, or any, I don't think that's an easy path. And I pray in all my lifetime so I never be subject to that insanity. Undoubtedly, whoever made me has done it enough times that maybe I can get away with that prayer. Maybe not. But if that's what it takes, I'm willing to do it for the benefit of all beings. That it's the devotion isn't, I think if I trust the devotion to being that which will be the commitment for me, it's hooked to interest, right? And trust the practice to be whether or not it's good or bad. I'm trusting the practice here. I'm not going to say devotion as long as it's not deluded. I'm going to say, okay, I can choose the perception. You know, the practice is already laid out. Is that clear? So I wouldn't go that way with it, but the rest of it I would agree. How do you know what somebody else is perceiving when that woman is bowing on the bus? How do you know it? You don't know. But it is devotion. And who knows, well, maybe that is exactly what she needs to do in order to move the consciousness to awakening. Who knows? It's better to believe that it is, for her path, isn't it? Than to think she's a stupid old woman and I'm going to push her over and grab her handbag and run. So that's an example of perception, you know.
You have a choice, you can wish it well, or you can...
And that's...